Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 14, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone is all about the story behind the recently decided McCutcheon versus the FEC campaign finance case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and, as always, our call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome today a special guest presenter, a man with a singular perspective on this case, which bears his name, McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. Sean McCutcheon is owner and chief executive officer of Colmont Electrical Development Company, and he is the author of the new book, Outsider Inside the Supreme Court, A Decisive First Amendment Battle. That is the book he's written about his journey to the U.S. Supreme Court and his journey in this case, McCutcheon versus the FEC. And with that, we're going to get some opening remarks of about 5 to 10 minutes from Mr. McCutcheon, but then we're going to be turning, as always, to the audience for your questions, so please do be thinking of your questions. We'll be turning to you in the next 10 minutes or so. With that, Mr. McCutcheon, the floor is yours. Please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Well, hello. My name is Sean McCutcheon, and my name has recently gained a lot of prominence in national politics and in the news media. I didn't do a whole lot to seek this attention other than I filed a lawsuit challenging a federal law on aggregate campaign finance limits for federal elections. But anyway, on last April 2nd, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in my favor in McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission. Since then, I'm kind of still your neighbor, Sean, but it has been a big change for me and countless people, especially in Washington and around, react urgently when they hear my name. You know, some are pretty happy about it, and others are not so happy. But regardless, for an electrical engineer from Alabama, it's been a very unusual experience, and the case has been interesting and fascinating to me. And hopefully today I can tell you more about what the case was about from a layman, non-lawyer standpoint, and what it's not about, which is extremely important. It is about aggregate limits and not about what they call base limits. But again, it goes back to during the last election cycle from 2011 to 2012, I was donating money to various federal candidates and also party committees and the parties and PACs, state committees. And also, I'm a conservative activist. I'm proud of that. And so I wanted to support candidates that shared my political views. But one of the party committees, the state Alabama GOP, notified me that I was approaching aggregate limits a few years ago. And I didn't even know what aggregate limits were, never had heard of them. I understood base limits, which were, $2,500 at the time per candidate for 5,000 for the cycle if you include the primary and the general election. But anyway, they told me about these limits and gave me a copy of the chart, and I was real confused by what I call the chart, which outlines the multiple ways you could reach the aggregate limits, which were around 123,000 per cycle. And there's different forms of them. They had a candidate limit, they had a PAC limit, they had a party limit, and then an overall limit. So there were four aspects to them. And basically, we filed a case saying that we wanted to, donate to more candidates. We basically approached the candidate aspect of it, although I was close to those limits on several fronts. And anyway, the case went through the court system, through the district court, and all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we won the decision on April 2nd in a 5-4 decision that basically threw out the federal aggregate limits, all of them, the limits on individual candidate donations, PACs, parties, and then also the overall limit. So at this point, individual private people can support as many candidates, parties, and committees as they choose in the election process, and I've been very excited with it. So it was a long process, although in terms of Supreme Court cases, probably not that long, but for me, it seemed like forever. But with that, that gives you a little background. I'm ready to answer questions and have a discussion.
All right. Thank you so much for those thoughts. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question for our guest today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our guest today, Mr. Sean McCutcheon, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to questions, let me just announce that tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be examining recent developments in government-compelled speech, not prohibited speech, but government-compelled speech, looking at the recently decided conflict minerals case, a case involving the American meat industry, and some other developments as well. Today, of course, we're talking about the McCutcheon versus FEC case, recently decided, as Mr. McCutcheon, our guest today, has noted, 5-4. Let me ask you this. It sounds like you're very pleased with the outcome of the case. Is it everything you had hoped for? Did you hope or expect to get more justices on your side? Are you concerned that there are this was such a narrow margin of victory?
Well, not really. I mean, again, the First Amendment's pretty plain to me. I don't understand why it wasn't 9-0, and there was a lot of speculation about how, you know, what the vote would be. I guess towards the end, I was thinking it would be 6-3 instead of 5-4, because I had felt like, based on the hour-long hearing that we had, the oral arguments, which to me just exceeded all expectations and was awesome. I had kind of felt like the Ginsburg, for whatever reason, was more amicable to the case.
Based on the way she held herself out during the oral argument?
Yeah, what she said in the oral argument sounded to me, but that she believed strongly in the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Once again, if you have a question for our expert, our phone lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're happy to take your questions. We've got one question pending at this point, so let's go to our first caller and continue to invite additional questions from our audience. Again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Yes, Mr. McCutcheon, this is Leo Dombrowski, Society member in Chicago. First off, congratulations on your victory. Second, the left usually does not react well to decisions like this, and can get, as I have seen, a bit strident and even go beyond that. I know it hasn't been long since the court announced the decision, but have you had any, any threats, veiled or otherwise, against you, your business, your family, for pursuing this matter?
Well, yes, sir, is the short answer to the question. But most of that happened immediately after the decision. I actually wasn't at my office. I was out of town in D.C. But we did have a lot of phone calls, emails, and letters that were fairly negative. I'm not sure whether they were from the left or who they were from, but I do know that a lot of the prominent left-wing leaders such as Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and Udall, Senator Udall, that they were very vocal about it being a bad decision by the Supreme Court. In fact, they're still discussing it. They had a Senate hearing just a little over a week ago where they were talking about a constitutional amendment to modify the First Amendment, which I find just extremely crazy. I mean, I'm really surprised that people actually think the way they do about free speech. Again, the whole issue to me was about freedom and free speech, and especially in the political process.
Follow-up question?
No, just good luck to you and keep up the good fight.
Thank you.
And thank you for your question. Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're talking with author Sean McCutcheon. He's the author of Outsider, Inside the Supreme Court, A Decisive First Amendment Battle. That book is available on Amazon.com and iTunes as well. And the link to that is in the materials we circulated to you in advance of this call, also available on our website. We've now got three questions pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Good afternoon, Mr. McCutcheon, and thank you for the presentation. My question is about the implications of the decision. How will it change political fundraising? What are the implications for somebody in races, state, local, or federal, that you see coming from this decision?
Well, I think I see several changes. The one thing we've certainly seen is that in the local aggregate limits in some states, which I forgot the exact number of states, it's not many, like 15 or something, those aggregate limits will probably fall as well. And so I'm hearing good things about, you know, state aggregate limits. And as far as the immediate impact that I've already seen, I believe that the classical parties, you know, like the RNC, the Senate committee and the House committee, will be able to raise a little more money in competition with super PACs and that kind of things, because private individuals will be able to donate more money to the parties. They can, you know, do essentially 100,000, a little less than that, instead of the 77 if that's all they do. And then, of course, if you combine that with other things like state parties, which are PACs, I think you're going to see an increase there. And, again, it's a positive change, because private individual people, and that is mainly people outside the government and, not corporations and not unions, these are private individual people, will be able to donate more into the process. So hopefully there'll be more money. I think we're seeing that based on some April fundraising numbers. And also that money will be coming from the best source, in my opinion, which is the people. So I think there'll be other implications in the state and local, but I don't understand them yet.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a question, if I could, Mr. McCutcheon, a follow-up. Are the state aggregate limits that you mentioned, are they being retracted by the states, or will they be challenged in court, or do you know how they're going to be undone, or if they will be undone?
I want to say Wisconsin, they were already challenged. We were actually involved in a case in New York that's really a Citizens United case on overall PAC limits of 150,000, but I've seen that in a couple of different states. From what I understand, there's been lawsuits in a couple of states, and then also some are just not going to enforce those aggregate limits.
Are you now likely to pursue other lawsuits of this nature, or are you out of the litigation for the moment, or what's next for you?
Well, I don't think I want to be a plaintiff in any more cases. A Supreme Court case is a lot, as you know. There's a lot of publicity in media, and plus all the legal implications. So I understand why sometimes it's hard to find clients. I've been hearing that about this case and other cases, that clients are difficult to find for some of these because of the, you know, different pressures that it puts on the individual that brings the case. And some of them you can understand on the front end, and some of them you will never understand until you're in the middle of them. So that is both exciting in that it's new, but also it can be, you know, stressful at times. Things like having to hire security or something like that you never had to do before. Yeah, and then, again, there are a lot of people that take this stuff too seriously in the negative direction, so that creates some negative things. But
you mentioned
I plan to, huh?
I was going to say, you mentioned some negative phone calls and emails you received after the decision. Did that happen as the case was moving along? You mentioned hiring security. Did you feel you did that early in the case?
Well, we had, you know, we had a few emails the whole way along from people we didn't know, you know, saying how bad they thought it was, and or you know, a lot of it's just kind of crazy stuff that doesn't make any sense. You know, a lot of it I never even looked at. I don't even know what it was, but it, and again, it really, there was really a lot after the on the decision day. I mean, the oral argument day produced some, you know, way back in October 8, 2013, but this April 2 was just massively more. I expected October 8 again in terms of publicity and media and all that, but in fact it was significantly more after the decision. So people actually came by our offices, and you know, there were a lot of phone calls, so it overloaded my secretaries and made some of my people uncomfortable. But that died down within a week after the decision. It's really not happening anymore.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. We've got three questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Heather Berlinski from Wisconsin, and I think my question was already answered, but it was regarding the implications of aggregate limits set in other states. And you are correct that Wisconsin's aggregate limit recently was fell last week when the Department of Justice issued a settlement with our elections board to not enforce our current aggregate limit as a result of your case. So we're very thankful that that happened last week. But my question was really what you're hearing from other states, and I think you indicated that there are 15 other states that may have aggregate limits. I was just wondering the extent of which other states have current actions pending, and whether those, any of those other states have also resolved their aggregate limit issues as well.
Well, I've heard about two or three other states. I've pretty much heard that they're all going to fall. The only other one I know specifically anything about is New York, because I was actually a witness in a case in New York involving you know, limits on PAC raising funds for PACs, and the judge in New York threw those limits out, and he did kind of said in his opinion, NYPPP versus Walsh was the case, New York Progress and Protection PAC, Craig Engel, and then Walsh is I think he's the AG of New York State, but the judge that ruled on it didn't really want to follow it, but from the way I understand the court system works, he had to throw out those limits. So that's what I expect all the aggregate limits to in all the states that have them to be ended.
Let's take another question from another caller.
My name is Fred Young, and confirming what the young lady said about Wisconsin, I was the plaintiff in the suit against the Government Accountability Board in Young versus the GAB, and we can't say that Wisconsin limits have been eliminated just quite yet. The agreements have been submitted to the federal district judge, who hasn't, to my knowledge, signed it yet, but I think it's just a matter of time. But we're very pleased, and I want to thank you, Mr. McCutcheon, for providing the basis for my success in my suit.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm very glad that I was able to help you, even though I didn't know I did. But been saying the whole time, I didn't know I had it in me. So,
but we thought we would win on the merits. We knew we wouldn't do it with the judge we had. We'd probably wind up in the Seventh Circuit. But your decision iced it, and it was all over. So, thanks again.
You're very welcome,
Mr. Young. If you know, are you aware of other suits at the state level in different states?
I am not.
Okay. Very good. We're speaking with Sean McCutcheon. His book is available on Amazon. It's titled Outsider Inside the Supreme Court, A Decisive First Amendment Battle. If you have a question, if you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller question remaining, and then our lines are open.
Mr. McCutcheon, my name is David Applegate. Like Leo Dombrowski, who was the first caller, I'm also a lawyer here in Chicago, and I want to thank you for sticking it out, as you said, with this case. But most important, thank you for being involved in the political process to begin with, which is much too important, in my opinion, to leave to professional politicians. Not having been present for the oral argument, my question is this. Did anyone who is concerned about the supposed corrupting power of money in politics, such as Speaker Pelosi or Senator Schumer, for example, ever suggest that they might simply refuse to accept these potentially corrupting contributions from constituents and run leaner campaigns instead of risking ruining the political process in the name of the First Amendment?
Well, I wish they would do that, but again, I feel like money coming from outside the government and not inside the government is the best source of money to get the best government we can get. But I certainly wish they would give up their war chest of money and in the name of free speech and do their best. But I don't think they're going to do that. At the same time, they're complaining about these changes that were coming along. They're also using the changes to raise money themselves. I mean, they're doing a lot of organizing and fundraising, and they're having success. So again, these rules are being gone opens it up more for really everybody, you know, Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, if they want to raise money from private people.
Well, obviously we're on the same side of this issue, but I just want to thank you again for bringing it to the fore and for striking an important blow for government of the people and by the people as well as for.
You're welcome. Thank you. And I think it's just a fundamental freedom of speech or just freedom issue about, you know, our right to support as many candidates, you know, parties and PACs as we choose. To me, it's fundamental.
Our lines are now open. There's no callers in the queue. If you have a question, if you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Mr. McCutcheon, one of the observations I've read about in this case is it would tend to empower the political parties and the PACs. You know, you can give now to any number of candidates that ceiling amount per candidate of $2,500, but the amounts you can give to I don't know if you want to say the PACs or the joint committees and so forth and so on have much higher limits or are otherwise unlimited, and that itself is an opportunity to exert undue influence. Is that a concern of yours, or did you agree with those assertions, or do you have a response to those types of concerns? Are they all covered by the quid pro quo limits that Justice Roberts would say are effective?
Well, they're covered by that and other circumvention, you know, things about how you name PACs and whether the same people can form multiple PACs. There are several rules out there, how much elected officials can give to another candidate, and of course PACs are limited in what they can give to a single candidate. And I think the PACs mainly are, you know, the state Republican parties, which are, you know, generally have a lot of members, a lot of people on those. So I don't really have any concerns. I think it's healthy for the PACs and the parties to raise more money.
You mentioned earlier, we do have one audience question pending, and I'll get to that momentarily. You mentioned earlier that at the outset of this case, you were advised, I think, by a state commission or someone that you were approaching the aggregate limit, and at that point in time, you had no idea what the aggregate limit was or that there was one or what it meant. Or do you have concerns that the system is just too sophisticated or too complicated, I don't want to say sophisticated, unnecessarily complicated in a way that makes it very difficult for people to know what the rules are and to follow the rules?
Oh, absolutely. I think that makes it that tends to cause people to not want to get involved because they're not sure of the risks. And, you know, again, I wanted to get involved in politics. I didn't even know about aggregate limits. But once I found out about aggregate limits, I thought they were very extremely complicated. You know, there wasn't a clear way that you reach an aggregate limit. And it just, certainly I believe a lot of the, I call them hoops or hurdles, hoops you got to jump through or hurdles that, to me, that makes it more difficult to participate in the process, and I think it intimidates a lot of people out of doing anything because, you know, they're concerned about what might happen, you know. So it certainly needs simplification, definitely. And, again, aggregate limits being gone did accomplish that.
Right.
You know, simplification.
No doubt about that. Did you say that, did I hear correctly, that a state committee or a state employee advised you that you were approaching, you were nearly exceeding the aggregate limit, and that's how you found out about it in the first place?
Yes, sir. The first time I ever heard about aggregate limits was in Alabama. You know, we call it ALGOP, which is the state Alabama GOP. I was on a finance committee for the President's Club for the Alabama GOP, and we had multiple meetings, and in one of those meetings they had an attorney for the party that gave us handouts, including the chart, and they talked about aggregate limits. That was the first time I ever heard of them. Now, I had already retained Dan Backer, a PAC lawyer, for doing grassroots PAC organizing, which is initially what caused me to seek out Dan Backer. I was actually wanting to form a super PAC and I knew I needed legal assistance with that. So, you know, the next time I saw or talked to Dan, I talked to him about, you know, aggregate limits, and he, of course, knew a lot more about them than I did, since that's what he does for a living. You know, he's one of the few campaign finance attorneys in the country that just does that all the time. And Dan said, oh, well, if you don't like, you know, he's from Russia and kind of direct. He said, if you don't like aggregate limits, we can challenge those. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't think I really want to challenge them. You know, that seemed like you know, like shooting for the stars kind of thing. But after we discussed it a little bit more, I decided we should challenge them.
And did he represent you all the way up to the Supreme Court, or was it a mix of attorneys? Or?
Well, it was a mix of attorneys. Initially, it was Dan and three of his partners. In his firm, I'll call us, it was initially some Tea Party lawyers, you know, grassroots, and then as it progressed and we got, you know, of course the Republican National Committee noticed that we were working on this because we got some rulings from the FEC and then we were going to go to the district court there in D.C. And so we had a big discussion and I decided that it would be best to allow the RNC to join up with us, both to get more lawyers and, you know, funding and everything else. So then we became one huge team, and I was in a meeting with 35 lawyers in the room and 10 more on the speakerphone. So it became a really big deal. But as we went through all that, it actually got complicated. When we got certiorari and we were headed to the Supreme Court, because once we have two different groups of lawyers, a lot of times they couldn't agree. So in the end, we had to get yet another firm, Bancroft, you know, Paul Clement and Aaron Murphy. Right towards the end, we retained them, and Aaron Murphy actually did the oral argument. It was kind of so there were a lot of lawyers involved.
All right. Well, we've got one question pending. If you want to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Bryant Poitras. I'm also a non-lawyer. I'm from a little town in Platte City, Missouri. And I think really my question has been answered within the last couple answers you've given. I was just trying to find out a little more about your personal time commitment, your journey in doing this, and it sounds like you're able to get some legal counsel early on within your local group there, and I know there's a lot of involvement. I try to be active in local politics here, but I was just trying to get you to expand on how somebody might be prepared for this, or whether local groups should be a little more should bone up on this type of preparation for challenges that we may meet in the future.
I'm not sure I understand what you're asking. Do you mean like in terms of if you get a case before the U.S. Supreme Court, or?
Well, specifically, I was asking about, you know, your time commitment on this particular case, but also secondarily about, you know, whether we need to have more legal advice going into our local election committees to just be aware of this type of, you know, the possibilities and the ramifications of what's going on with these things.
Well, yes, sir. I would, as far as the time it took, you know, let's just talk in terms of work. And luckily, I was far along in my career, and I could miss the kind of work that I did and deal with the issues. You know, it wouldn't have been possible earlier in my career, but luckily, I started my business in 1996. So, you know, when this came up, I probably missed altogether last year almost 2 months of work. Which is the most I've ever missed since I started working since age 18. Well, you know, or 22 if you count after college. But the point is that it took a lot of time. Some of the stuff I probably didn't have to participate. I mean, in appellate law, you don't have to go to an oral argument, but I really wanted to go to the oral argument because it was exciting and I wanted to see what was going on. And then along the way, I had several meetings. I probably didn't have to be as involved as I was, but to some extent, yes, you know, you had to sign a lot of documents and meet lawyers so you could, you know, understand what what's going on. Now, also, I did some training and speeches in the committees and, you know, as far as the state and the Young Republicans. And here in Alabama, we had a couple of events where I did some training and question answer sessions like we're doing now. And I found out that even people in the committees that do this every day, even a lot of consultants that work on campaigns do not really know much about campaign finance law. So I would say it's a big yes to, we should inform, you know, people in the committees and that do this as much as we can to give them familiarity and comfort with what the rules are, so they're willing to get more involved and do more. And of course, it's easier now that aggregate limits are gone, but I would say certainly on that.
Thank you.
You mentioned before that you were satisfied with the outcome of the case. Would you, knowing what you know now about the time investment and the trials and tribulations, would you do it all again if you went back in time to when this whole thing started?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. I would do it all again. I'm very pleased. But then again, I love politics. It's exciting to me. And a lot of the problems that turned off some of my friends and family don't really bother me. But you know, there is a lot of people do think that I'm crazy for being involved in this, but I would go back and do it again. And some of the lawyers in the RNC, and they had several lawyers in the process, like John Ryder's one example, but some of them felt like that the case would not, that all aggregate limits may not be struck, that somehow they would just do individual limits and not include the parties or have some limit on JFCs. I heard a lot of theories. A JFC is a joint fundraising committee. I heard a lot of theories about how they might rule, but in the end, they just simply struck aggregate limits, you know, all of them. And I think it was nice and simple and easy what they did, and I'm very pleased with the outcome. I would say I got exactly what I wanted, so I sent Erin Murphy a big thank you letter for the excellent job she did arguing the case, in my opinion, because, you know, I never really, the base limit aspect, I don't, We really only challenged aggregate limits. I know the people in the media talked a lot about base limits, and were always asking about base limits. Isn't this, you know, they'd say over and over again, isn't this a case about base limits and just to do away with all limits? Well, not really. The case was actually about aggregate limits, and all aggregate limits were struck. So I think that it was just what actually happened was exactly what we asked to happen, and it was smooth and simple. So I'm excited. And then as far as the process, you know, I handled a lot of the media myself through a media firm named Levick in D.C. And so the media, which is what everybody told me would be the worst part, turned out to be very enjoyable, and I actually had a good time. And for a conservative, I did okay in the media. So that part that everybody thought would be a nightmare was not bad. And then the oral argument was just awesome, it being in the court. It's only an hour long, but I couldn't believe the humor and what all went on in there, the high-level discussion. So I was real impressed with the whole process and learned so much. So it made it exciting. So absolutely, I'd go back and do it again in a heartbeat. So I just don't know, you know, how it could be any better, really.
Good to hear. If you have a question, if you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller question pending at this point, and then our lines are open.
So, Mr. McCutcheon, it's Dave Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California. And first, I want to echo the praise that some of the other callers have directed and urged, you know, to you, and sort of regard you a bit of as a modern hero willing to do battle in legal forum. I've got a couple of just quick questions, if I might. One just sort of has to sort of calibrate us who are listening about sort of like what the aggregate, you know, cost or expense of this has been. You mentioned a bit of, you know, about your time involved, but there's also a lot of lawyers that you've mentioned as well, and media, PR, whatever else. Just to get a sense of, you know, what it actually costs to take a case like this all the way up through the Supreme Court. And, you know, it sounds like you may have had the means to finance this yourself, but your thoughts on other plaintiffs who perhaps have meritorious cases, but for the lack of financing, don't find themselves in a position to pursue those in court. If you have any thoughts on how that could be, how that problem could be addressed. Thanks.
Yes, sir. Well, a lot of the cost of this case was covered by the Republican National Committee, which is one of the reasons we teamed up with them. And I don't even know all the numbers. You know, some of their lawyers were on staff. I don't, you know, I'm sure they have totals on that. But, you know, you better be thinking about, you know, if it's a case this large and you go all the way to the Supreme Court, and, you know, I think you're talking about seven figures, not six, you know, altogether. Now, I spent a lot of money on media too, you know, writing a book and doing things like that, and just the travel and all the stuff is significant. So it is a lot of money, and I don't think that's going to change. One of the things I'm doing now, you asked what I'm going to do after what's next for Sean McCutcheon. Well, I'm going to continue to pursue free speech, not as a plaintiff of lawsuits, but, you know, free speech and campaign finance things through an organization called Coolidge Reagan. And basically that's the four of the attorneys that were in the, you know, in the case. We've gotten to know each other fairly well, so we have formed an organization. And then I'm going to donate, and other donors are going to donate, and we'll bring cases. To me, working through foundations and organizations is the best way to get these financed if you don't have the money to, you know, there's lots of, not just First Amendment, but lots of constitutional advocacy organizations out there that have lawyers and can handle the complexity and possibly some of the financing. It's going to, again, depend on what the case is. Luckily, in my case, the RNC was interested in this, so they were able to help me because it was getting a little too big for me or any individual. But I do think it's important that because of the high cost of a Supreme Court case, you know, probably being in the $1 million range by the time you add everything up, that, you know, you understand that on the front end and that you make arrangements to where that can happen because so you can hire the good counsel you're going to need to go all the way, because sometimes the initial counsel you start off with may not be able to or even be licensed. I mean, it's to argue before the Supreme Court requires a special license. So,
mm-hmm. And if I could ask a follow-up question, please. There's
sure.
Part of the argument, you know, for these campaign finance limits is it all revolves around the anti-corruption or the corruptive effect of money in politics. And I mean, I guess my question to you is that, you know, given that you supported a large number of candidates, was really the access to the candidates, getting their ear, was that a significant part of your decision in supporting them? And would you have just been just as happy to contribute anonymously? And if you contributed anonymously, arguably there would be no corruptive effect because your identity would not be known. So, you know, in your like calculus, were you just more supportive of candidates in general that you were like-minded with, or was actually candidate access a significant part of your decision?
Well, candidate access was definitely not a major thing. A lot of these candidates I didn't meet in person. I just read their stuff or heard about them. And again, I was sort of anti-incumbent. Another thing that hadn't been talked about is I'm not completely anti-incumbent. I supported some incumbents, but a lot of the candidates I supported didn't even win. So I was looking for constitutional type, you know, freedom candidates and challengers a lot of times. So it was more about, you know, it's kind of like you have a corporation and you have a board of directors and you have, you know, officers. If you're not getting the results in the corporation that you want to see, then, you know, you bring in new people. That's kind of the way I'm looking at it. You know, we have 95% incumbency and most people feel like America's on the decline. And has been for several years now in a lot of different ways, but basically it's opportunity, you know, loss of opportunity, loss of prosperity. And there's a lot of theories about why that is, but my theory is the government's too large and too invasive into the, you know, so freedom to me brings opportunity, which then brings prosperity. So I'm looking for us to elect a whole bunch of new candidates that can get back to the basic principles of freedom so that we can have opportunity again, and then the prosperity will return last after we get the first part right. So that's kind of the way I'm looking at it is, and no, donating anonymous would be fine. I just see that the candidates that, especially challengers, are up against a huge challenge of raising money against an incumbent that has a war chest of money that they've had a lot more time to raise. You know, they have that year round, year after year. And so, I mean, you can look online at the war chest of incumbents. Some of them are, you know, way over $1 million they have sitting there. And then these incumbent challengers come along and want to get elected and do great things. And some of them are good managers, but they're not, you know, they're not rich. They can't self-fund. So where are they going to raise the money they need to run these ads in the media and, you know, and get out there and get their message out? And, you know, it's kind of hard, okay? So that's what I was saying is we need to make it easier for these candidates to raise money so they can be competitive and get their ideas out. And even if some of them don't get elected, a lot of times those ideas that they present during the process have to be adopted by whoever does win because, you know, they have to adjust to make sure they win the election. So I think it's a positive process, the whole thing. So.
Well, it has
been
a
forward to more money in politics.
Mr. McCutcheon, it has been observed that every campaign finance law ever adopted was adopted by the incumbents. So maybe in part you're saying that the laws are written in a way that favor incumbency. Let me make a final call for questions, see if we have another question for our guest today, Sean McCutcheon. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got a few minutes left. Okay, well, I don't see any final questions. Mr. McCutcheon, you want to take a minute, and do you have a final thought, or you want to wrap up in any way before we adjourn the call?
Well, I will say, if you want to find out more details, there's a couple of books out there. I wrote one of them, Outsider Inside the Supreme Court, and then Ronald Collins wrote the other one, When Money Speaks. The mine's the short one that reads fast and easy, 9 chapters, and there's a lot of stuff by all the, you know, major players in this, which includes lawyers, political officials. Even Obama made comments that we have documented in the book. Ryan Priebus, we talked with him, and all that's outlined, the process we went through. We have a chapter on media, some general background on the case. But if you like the legal aspects, the When Money Speaks is like a 900 or 700 page book, I think, with all kinds of legal analysis. So there's two good books out there that can give you all the details you want on the case if you're interested.
Well, thank you. And Mr. McCutcheon's book is available at Amazon and on iTunes, and a link to the book page is available in the notice you got of today's call. But Mr. McCutcheon, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been very interesting. I'm not sure we've ever had a guest before who was a named plaintiff in a U.S. Supreme Court case. It's been quite an education. I certainly appreciate you joining us today. And to our audience, thank you for joining us as well. Thank you for your time and for your joining the discussion and asking questions. And a reminder to our audience that tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time is our next Teleforum conference call. We will be examining recent developments in compelled government speech, not forbidden government speech, but compelled government speech, looking at the recently decided conflict minerals case and some other cases as well. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.